As of Tuesday, August 25, there were more than 5.9 million cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. and over 178,000 deaths. This is more cases than any other country in the world. The state of Maryland accounts for over 105,000 of these cases and more than 3,500 of the confirmed deaths. The nine counties on Maryland's eastern shore have about 5,370 some of these cases and account for 161 deaths. And this has all occurred in the past 6 months. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest this morning is Dr. Michael Murphy, an emergency medical physician affiliated with the Peninsula Regional Medical Center in Salisbury, Maryland. Mike is a frequent guest on Delmarva Today, and we're pleased to welcome him this morning to update us on the pandemic in our area and to discuss the development of any recent treatments. Dr. Murphy, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Thank you, Hal. Glad to be here.
Michael, let's begin with the numbers in our area. The last time we talked, a little over a month ago, there were 10 patients in the Peninsula Regional Medical Center. What is the status of the local caseload today?
Currently, there are 8 patients in the hospital at PRMC. Eight COVID patients. The hospital is much fuller than that, but only 8 with COVID.
Well, that's good news that at least the number is down from a month and a half ago at any rate. But we long anticipated a spike in cases in the fall. And when you look at what's happened across the country, states like Texas and Arizona and California, The spike seems to have occurred during the summer months. Are we still anticipating a spike in cases in our area in the fall?
I think we can still be concerned that a spike could occur in the fall. Yeah, as the temperature goes down, people move inside. You start to have more people gathered together, whether it's on college campuses, whether it's just in homes. Spread can happen. I think we need to anticipate a spike as possible. I think we're doing everything we can to minimize that by following the guidelines the state have laid out in terms of mask use, social distancing. I think if we continue to do those things, that will be helpful.
Michael, are you still dressing out in full protective gear in the hospital?
Yes.
Now, regardless of who comes in to be treated?
Every patient we're basically using. It's not as extensive, perhaps, as it was in March, April, and May. Certainly the face mask and shield is used. I'm using those with every patient.
I was wondering about the growth in the fall, which is almost here. Now, with schools partially opening, colleges receiving students, and doing in-person classwork with numbers of students, do you anticipate that they may well contribute to a growth in the fall?
I think that really depends on the students. I think the universities have very solid plans in place. I think they're very much are anticipating the needs in terms of testing, sample testing, contact tracing, making sure that students have the opportunity to socially distance, making sure that there are plans for people to wear masks in public, and those things. The plans coming from the universities, at least in the University of Maryland system, seem very strong. I think that they are doing everything they can to try to get kids a more normal, and I say more normal, it's not completely normal, educational experience. You can take, for example, I don't know if you saw today, Towson has decided that they're going to go to completely online courses after they had a number of students test positive. And there's a number of reasons for why Towson chose to do that. The students testing positive, my understanding that their local positivity rate just within the community and such, and because it's such a high commuter campus, they decided that it would be best to back off and only have classes online to prevent any further spread in that community. You know, University of Maryland at College Park, they're doing the first 2 weeks online, and then they're going to see what the spread's like and see if they would then be able to open it up to more in-person classes. They're such a huge campus with, you know, 30 to 40,000 kids. That seems to be a very good plan for that size campus. And then locally, you know, Salisbury University has a very good plan together in terms of testing, surveillance testing, contact tracing. They have areas set up to quarantine anyone who comes down with symptoms or who may test positive, and then plans what to do with students once they, if they test positive. It seems like the plan is there to try to give these kids a somewhat appropriate educational experience while sort of operating in the middle of a pandemic.
On a personal level, Michael, I know that both of your children are going to, children, not anymore, but both of your young people in your household are going to college now. And I think you had told me earlier that both of them are going to the campus for some in-person instruction. Are you comfortable with having your children at the university now?
Yeah, I am. I think, like I said, I think Maryland has a very good plan together. You know, technically the one is going to be off campus in a house, but one will be on campus. The University of Maryland has set it up so that everybody has their own room, no roommates. They do have common bathrooms. But they, like I said, the first 2 weeks people will be quarantined. They'll be doing everything online and see how the spread goes. Now, how that plays out, really, like I said at the beginning, is going to be up to the students. You look at my alma mater, I went to Notre Dame, and Notre Dame had a very good plan together. And then the first weekend, there were a couple of off-campus parties, and you've got several hundred kids that are not social distancing, not wearing masks. And there was a large uptick in
that'll be interesting. Go ahead, Michael.
No, just if, you know, students have to realize that this is a serious thing, and they're trying to give you a college experience. It's not going to be the normal college experience. The idea that we can sort of come to campus and have these large gatherings and parties is not really in the cards for these guys. And I feel for them because we, those of us who are that age, had that experience. And but if you really want the campus experience, there's going to be some things that have to be limited.
It'll be interesting in Salisbury to see if the students will avoid the kind of off-campus parties that they are prone to participate in. And I think your point is really well taken. It's there's some responsibility that the students carry in this case. Let me turn to a caseload again. Wicomico County has experienced the largest caseload on Maryland's eastern shore with about 1,400 cases. Why would you say that this county has had more cases than any other? Is it a question of population size, or are there other reasons?
I certainly think population plays into it. It's sort of the most, if you will, it's the most populated area on the eastern shore. It's also sort of the hub. People come here from other towns. And it's also, I think, the sort of the employment profile. A lot of jobs, including the poultry industry, that are line workers. And there are a number of other industries, radio filters, the microwave companies, where people are working in line with each other very closely. And that lends itself to easy spread. I'd also, I think, hit the nursing home, a couple of the nursing homes. And that those areas are also, they lend themselves to easy spread. And so I think initially those big spikes came from those areas. Those were recognized. The industries have done a very good job with social distancing and making sure their employees are safer. And I think that's why the numbers are down.
It's interesting to me that this virus is moving so fast that it has been only approximately 6 months since the first cases were reported. And I was just wondering what you and the medical community and the scientists have learned about this virus over the past 6 months that you've been working with it.
I think we've, in terms of the care that we are providing has changed in several ways, recognizing who the sickest of the sick are and how to deal with those very sick patients has changed. You know, initially, everybody was being placed on a ventilator with very high oxygen levels because this virus really causes people to have very low oxygen numbers when they come to the hospital. And so I think it's been recognized that putting those patients immediately on a ventilator actually was not the best way to do it. And so we've recognized different ways to provide oxygen to patients who need it, to provide them the support for their breathing without putting them on a ventilator or breathing machine. And also some simple things. There was a study that recognized a very simple old medication called dexamethasone, which is a steroid, is very helpful in advanced cases. Other treatments, remdesivir is another one that has sort of come to the forefront that's being used in very sick cases as well. So it's a recognition of how to deal with the sickest patients. I think there's also some recognition that the virus may have changed slightly. It's maybe a little bit more contagious, but not quite as viral in terms of its how much damage it causes to its host.
What does it mean, Mike, that it's not quite as viral?
Well, I think we're seeing more people getting it and fewer people necessarily hospitalized or even dying from it. And that's not to say, and I don't want people to hear that and say that it's now safe, okay? There are still, especially people with comorbid illnesses, you know, I think there were two deaths at PRMC last week. So it's still a very serious disease, but it's, I think, more contagious. It's easier to catch, but even the people that have fewer comorbidities are not as sick from it.
Is that a natural change in viruses that you find, that they become over time somewhat less viral?
You know, I'm not a virologist or even an epidemiologist, but it makes sense if you think about how viruses act. They have to have a host. And if a virus is too aggressive and too viral and causes the death of the host before the virus can spread, then the virus itself is going to die as well because it can't find a new host. And so you would think that over time it's going to mutate to a less viral form so that it can continue to spread from host to host, sort of like a common cold does. Not that this is a common cold, but just using that as an example, it's not, common cold generally doesn't kill people. And so it can multiply and spread throughout the entire population. A more viral virus, like an Ebola, burns through its host so quickly that if there's not someone there readily available to spread to, then the Ebola can be pretty readily contained as long as it's recognized and people are kept sort of in a contained area.
You mentioned various treatments, remdesivir as an example. We're hearing now about a treatment that the FDA has approved on an emergency basis called convalescent plasma. What is that, Michael? And how does it impact the coronavirus?
So plasma is the fluid in your bloodstream. So if you were to take a pint of blood out of your arm, and you put it in a container and you remove all of the red blood cells, the cells that carry oxygen. When you remove those red blood cells, the fluid that's left that carries those red blood cells is the plasma. And the plasma carries proteins that help your body make blood clots, and they proteins that help with your immune system, and proteins that help other organs function. And so part of those proteins are antibodies. And so theoretically, if someone who has survived COVID should have the antibodies to COVID in their plasma. And if you use that plasma in someone who's sick, those antibodies will attack the COVID in that recipient's bloodstream.
Well, speaking of the antibodies, I had heard that a couple of people were identified who had this virus and caught it twice. Is that a possibility, and how would that work?
Well, certainly, as with any infection, there's as I always tell people, there's no never and always in medicine. There's a spectrum, and the case you're referring to, there was a guy in Hong Kong who had coronavirus, I believe it was in April, and then just a few weeks ago had it again. And it's not clear to me how they figured out he had it, because the second time he had it, he was completely asymptomatic. But it was an actual second infection. They were able to extract the DNA of the virus and figure out that it was a different sort of form of COVID that had infected him. I think that is a possibility of, again, having the disease, or having the virus present in your body, but having the disease are two different things. The person that I read the article about never had really any symptoms of the second infection, and more importantly, seemed to mount a defense against it. He had antibodies in his bloodstream that attacked the virus, which I think is very encouraging. Again, you can't say always and never in medicine, but the fact that this person had had it before, he got it again, but essentially didn't really have any symptoms from it. It wasn't a disease that was harmful to him at all, because his body formed antibodies and was able to fight the infection. So it's possible, but if you look at it worldwide, how many tens of millions of people have had this, and we have one case of somebody who's been infected again, one in 20 million, one in 10 million, I think that's a possibility, but it's and statistically not likely that it's going to happen again.
Yeah, I understand that as well. Let me ask you about a change in policy that actually just came to light today. I believe that the normal guideline from the CDC was that if you are exposed to COVID-19, whether you have symptoms or not, you should probably get yourself tested. And now there's a subtle change in the guideline that says if you're exposed to someone with the virus, but you have no symptoms, that probably you don't need to be tested. Are you familiar? It's just occurred today, I believe. Are you familiar with this?
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what do you think about this as a CDC guideline change?
I heard this. Part of it, there's some common sense behind it. This is a very contagious disease. If you've been exposed, you need to act like you have it. The problem is, from an epidemiological standpoint, from contact tracing, it doing the test is going to be better, because then you can figure out who had it and who has the capability of spreading it. I don't know how the CDC came to make this decision, whether it was based on the fact that it's still not easy to get a test. Are they trying to conserve tests? Was this a made by someone based on a political need, it's hard to say. I can say that the epidemiologists think that this is a bad idea, just because we need, it's better to know who's had it so that we can know how it's being spread and have a better understanding of it. So that their take on it is, we still need to be testing people that have close contacts, but it certainly makes perfect sense if you come in contact with somebody who has had it. You know, if you're a college student and your boyfriend has COVID, you have COVID. You should consider yourself having had COVID. And the presence or absence of a test scientifically will help the community understand contact tracing, but you should still consider yourself as having COVID.
Well, there is the issue of trying, in this country anyway, to get this virus under some kind of control, because it's impacting, clearly, our economy, it's impacting our educational system, it's impacting the social network of the whole country, and to have some kind of sense of control of it would seem to me, anyway, from my layman's point of view, that the more we know about it, the better, and the more we know about its spread, the better.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think we, you know, that the epidemiologists and the virologists may want to know who's had it, where they are, who they've been in contact with, what buildings they've been in, what stores they've been in. Yeah, all of those things will lead, you know, the greater the knowledge we have, the sooner we can get this over with, the sooner we can really get this under control.
Michael, we hear, speaking of control, we hear the race is on to create a vaccine now, and we hear that we may have one by December. We hear that it may take longer than that. What is your sense of where we are on the development of a vaccine, and not just the development of a vaccine, but having it available to the general public?
That's a great question, because the presence of a vaccine doesn't mean that everybody's been vaccinated, right? It's my understanding that the vaccines that are being worked on in America are in stage three. Basically, they're getting human volunteers to take the vaccine, and then they can study them to see if they mount any type of antibody or immune response. Now, you have a vaccine, you have to make sure that the vaccine is safe and effective. So you want not only for them to be able to mount a response to the coronavirus, but it needs to be safe in its administration. And so that's why we have to do the, it can take a very long time for most vaccines to come to market. And so I wouldn't anticipate any vaccine being available before the end of the year. Now it's just August, and I could be wrong, and they may have things, they're working on a very accelerated pace, but in terms of its mass ability to be distributed to 300 million people, I wouldn't anticipate that being possible before the end of the year.
Michael, in the 1950s, I remember the significant issue of thalidomide, and particularly in Germany, a drug developed to treat various forms of cancer and a number of other ailments. The results of the problems with thalidomide were horrible. Not only the death of so many infants, but also the kind of deformities that were created. And it just seems to me that presents a caution for us in terms of rushing vaccines to market. How have our testing of vaccines, and I know you're not a virologist, but How have our development of vaccines changed to the degree that now we can produce them and make them available so much more quickly?
I don't know the answer to that directly. I guess I'd have to leave that to the virologists and the folks that make the vaccines. I think most of it is going to be because it's technologically based. The proteins can be that are necessary for the virus can be grown and made probably in a much more rapid and much more widespread way than growing a polio virus on an egg yolk. The technology is probably what I would point to. And I think, it's also a function of manpower and support from governmental agencies and monetary support. As you go through and different vaccines have come to the market, they've been felt to be important. They've been felt to be essential, but they were developed slowly over time by a few researchers, virologists, immune specialists. When you sort of pool all of those resources together, I think you're going to be able to do things a lot more quickly. Some of this is supposition, of course, but I think it's a matter of manpower and monetary support.
Right, and probably as you say, the technological capacity that has changed dramatically since at least that period. Anyway, well, Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining me again today on Delmarva Today. And this virus is moving, and it's moving so quickly. I want to ask if you will be willing to come back again in another month or so and update us on where we are in combating this COVID-19.
Absolutely, Hal, anytime.
I appreciate it very much, Michael. Thank you. And I want to thank all of you for joining us today on Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.